You're listening to the Talking Rheumatology Spotlight Podcast, brought to you by the British Society for Rheumatology.
Many thanks for joining us for this BSR podcast on IgG4-related disease. We're very fortunate to have Professor David DeCruz with us, who is a consultant rheumatologist at the Louise Coote Lupus Unit at Guy's and St Thomas's NHS Trust. I'm Yick Mann, one of the rheumatology consultants at Lewisham and Greenwich NHS Trust. So welcome, David.
Thank you very much, Yick. Thank you very much.
So IgG4 is a rare fibroinflammatory disease, and it was first recognized as a unified condition around the start of the 21st century. So some of our listeners may be very familiar with the condition, but some may have never seen a single case. And I know that you have a large cohort of patients at Guy's Hospital, and most of my own personal experience in treating IgG4-related disease was when I trained under you. So I think we're very lucky that you're joining us today. So we hope that this podcast will provide a general overview into the history of the disease, the diagnosis and the management. And I'm sure you'll share some of the interesting cases that you've managed over the years.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So to start off with, what is IgG4-related disease and when did it first come to your attention?
So IgG4 disease, fascinating condition. It's, you know, like the other conditions that we see, it's a multi-system autoimmune rheumatic disorder. And it first came to my attention, I guess, about 10, 12 years ago, when I started seeing patients with this unusual presentation of lumps and bumps.
Yeah.
And then actually, to be honest, I read John Stone's fantastic review in the New England Journal of Medicine, which really set the ball rolling. It was a very thought-provoking article. And then, you know, once you learn about a condition, you start looking out for it. And then, you know, then the patients flowed. So we have quite a large cohort. I think we must have over 100 patients with IgG4 disease now. And the presentation is usually, the histories are very long. What I've learned, Yick, is that these patients have a very long sort of indolent disease course. They present with a few aches and pains, some occasional night sweats and some fevers. It doesn't usually present very acutely other than renal involvement. So they present with sort of lumps and bumps. And then I guess the thing here is you need to think of the diagnosis.
Yeah.
So there's three phenotypes, broadly, three phenotypes. There's the head and neck disease, which we do see a lot of. There's the retroperitoneal fibrosis aortitis group. And then there's the autoimmune pancreatitis and hepatobiliary disease. And we've got patients with all those. And then we've also got the rarer presentations, people with cerebral involvement with the pachymeningitis and hyperphysitis, some lung involvement, and orbital disease. So being a tertiary referral center, we have a referral bias. So one of the big referral biases actually is Mr. Tim O'Brien and Miss Archie Fernando run, they're consultant urologists at Guy's Hospital. And before I started working with Tim and Archie, I think I'd only ever seen one patient with retroperitoneal fibrosis. They've now got 400 patients in their clinic. And this is a national retroperitoneal fibrosis clinic. And I guess about 10% of those patients in that RPF clinic do have IgG4-related disease. So we've built up our experience working with Tim and Archie, and they are very challenging patients. So these patients sometimes present with acute obstruction, ureteric obstruction, because the RPF mass compresses the ureters, and they present with hydronephrosis, needing decompression, sometimes needing stenting. Yeah. The other referral pathway is from Moorfields and ENT. So Moorfields have sent us a lot of lumps and bumps around the eyes. And the ENT surgeons have sent, you know, lumps and bumps around the head and neck area, parotid swelling and submandibular gland swellings. And what I've learned actually is that when you palpate these, they feel really hard. They're very solid, these lymph nodes. They're not sort of soft and squishy like you see in lupus and Sjogren's. They are very, very hard. And that's something I've learned over the years.
A very useful tip for our listeners.
That's right. And actually what Mr. O'Brien said when he operates on these patients, they've come presenting in ureteric obstruction. He has to operate on them and do a ureterolysis. And he said, David, you know, chipping away at these ureters is like chipping into concrete. It is really, really solid material. So I guess that's one of the distinguishing features from the other autoimmune rheumatic diseases that we see. The hepatobiliary patients, we don't see that many of. They usually go straight to our gastroenterology colleagues.
Yes.
And I've been working closely with Dr. Emma Culver, who's a gastroenterologist, hepatobiliary specialist in Oxford, who runs the IgG4 MDT, which I'll come back to later on. So she's got a very large collection of the hepatobiliary disease patients. So that's basically the broad group. Our patients are usually middle-aged, but I've seen a pediatric onset patient with hypophysitis, and I've also seen patients at the extreme end, old age, in their 80s. So the whole age spectrum. I've not noticed an ethnic predisposition, unlike lupus, okay, where there's obviously a major predilection for people of African and Asian ancestry. It seems to be all races. Genders in our group, it's slightly more males than females, but there's not a lot in it. And as I say, the disease duration is really very long. And I think that also speaks to the prognosis of IgG4 disease. Generally, these patients do pretty well, except when they present with organ-threatening disease. Yeah. And we have had one patient who died from renal IgG4 disease, and she just relentlessly progressed to renal failure, and she had overwhelming sepsis and died. I've not had too many patients die directly from IgG4 disease. So in general, the prognosis is very good. In terms of epidemiology, nobody knows, basically. There's one study from Japan which has highlighted that, but it is only one study, and it's very difficult to do epidemiology in this very rare disease, but I think they will come. Now that there are classification, there's actually, unusually for a rheumatic disease, there are both ACR EULAR classification criteria, and the Japanese have put together a comprehensive diagnostic criteria. Okay. So that helps the diagnosis, and also helps to recruit patients. Once you've got a classification criteria, yeah, you can recruit patients into clinical trials. And there's also an outcome measure. There is the response index. So quite a lot more is known about IgG4 disease than when I first started working with you.
Yes, it certainly sounds like a very exciting disease, and there's still quite a lot we don't know about this condition.
Yeah.
I think
partly
because it's quite new, but partly also because it's a very rare condition. Mm. So what do we know so far about the pathophysiology of this condition? And is IgG4 itself pathogenic?
So as more is known about this over the last 10 years, a lot more is known about the immunopathology of IgG4 disease. It's clearly a B-cell driven disease. So a B-cell hyperactivity, a little bit like lupus, is a B-cell predominant disease. But clearly T-cells are involved. The cytotoxic T-cells are clearly involved. And the pathology basically is complicated. So we think it's B-cell hyperactivity. Plasma blasts are also very much involved. And actually, John Stone has proposed you measuring plasma blasts as a way of monitoring disease response. Not a lot of units have access to plasma blast measurements, but he's shown very clearly that plasma blast levels do improve. I guess the main pointer towards B cells being important is rituximab. Rituximab has worked brilliantly in these patients. And you see B cell depletion, you see improvements in IgG4 levels, correlating with disease improvement. Now, 2 points about serum IgG4 levels. They can be very misleading. So about 30% of patients with cast iron biopsy-proven IgG4 disease, 30% of those patients will have normal serum IgG4 levels,
yes,
in which case it's not useful. There are other patients with absolutely massive levels of IgG4 levels, in which case it is useful because those levels do decline. The cellular immunity is very important, but that's rather difficult to assess at the bedside in clinic. But we do know that cytotoxic T cells are important, and the whole T cell repertoire is activated. And again, we see that improvements in the basic sciences have shown that after rituximab, levels of some of these pathogenic T cells do improve. And that tells us that B cells talk to T cells. And when you wipe out the B cells, that interaction between B and T cells is broken. Right. Rather like we see in lupus, yeah.
Yes. And going back to the bedside, like you said, what is your approach in diagnosing IgG4-related disease? I know we've touched upon blood tests, histology, and potential imaging, but what is your general approach to diagnosing it?
Just to finish about, is IgG4 pathogenetic? That's a really good question, because actually IgG4 in the normal immune system is actually protective. It's an anti-inflammatory molecule. What switches it to being pathogenetic, nobody knows. But yes, the answer is that it almost certainly isn't a pathogenetic autoantibody. So in terms of diagnosis, I think the important thing, as with all rare diseases, is think of the diagnosis. If you don't think of the diagnosis, you haven't got a hope of making the diagnosis. But again, these are patients you know, I'm slightly biased because of the referral pathway, the head and neck disease, the retroperitoneal disease, and the hepatobiliary diseases. They come, it's very much like pattern recognition, as in all of medicine. Once you've recognized a pattern, you know to look out for it.
So and hopefully the spotlight and this podcast on IgG4 disease will raise recognition, which is what we're aiming for.
So you mentioned an interesting case. So we had a patient who must have been about 15, 20 years ago. We were certain had Sjogren's. She had massive swellings around the eyes, huge parotid swelling, huge submandibular gland swellings, modest ESRs and CRPs, but negative antibodies. And yet we thought, well, this looks like Sjogren's disease. Gave her a short course of steroids and hydroxychloroquine. Nothing happened. She still comes to our clinic very faithfully. And we thought, could this be IgG4 disease? She had been seen by the oral medicine team at Guy's Hospital, who did do a biopsy off the parotid gland. So we got them out, stained them again, and she had screaming IgG4 disease. Her IgG4 to IgG plasma ratio was over 80%, and she had the full house storiform fibrosis, obliterative phlebitis. So in retrospect, she's somebody we missed completely. She was masquerading as Sjogren's, but actually had IgG4 disease all along. So I guess that's the diagnostic clue. And as I mentioned to you before, as a tip, just palpate the glands.
Yes.
If they feel rock hard, they're usually painless in my experience. Rock hard glands, think about IgG4 disease. And do you
usually see bilateral or unilateral?
Yeah, it's usually bilateral. Yeah. So unilateral would worry me. So unilateral lymphadenopathy would be a little bit concerning. And actually, just reading the guidelines again, the guidelines do say beware of unilateral lymphadenopathy. You're thinking of other diseases or maybe even lymphoma. But it's usually symmetrical, usually bilateral, usually extensive, usually rock hard. So that's the head and neck. The orbital disease, again, these patients can have quite striking dacryoadenitis. And the Moorfields team usually do a biopsy, mainly to exclude malignancy. And I have been caught out once before, a young woman referred from Moorfields with an apparent dacryoadenitis. The IgG4 stain was positive, but she did not respond to steroids, and she surprisingly did not respond to rituximab. And so we got the biopsies out again and restained them, and it turned out that she had, believe it or not, an IgG4 MALT lymphoma. So you can get caught out with these patients. So if your medicines are not working, think again and relook at the biopsy is the message.
Just in reference to that case, I think I wrote it up with you.
I've actually included
that's
what you did.
The abstract in this spotlight. So if anyone's interested in reading about that case, then the reference is in the spotlight.
Yeah. Well remembered, Jig. So in terms of clinical assessment, as always, it's detailed history, examination. And I always start my, as you know, I always start my consultations about which year did your first symptom start? And nearly always it's many, many years ago that they first had their first symptoms. And I think that's one clue in making the diagnosis. Examining them and then imaging. So in the head and neck, usually the ultrasonographers here are very good at scanning the parotid and submandibular glands and giving you an idea about whether this is malignant or reactive, or indeed they can diagnose Sjogren's with sialadenitis. Blood tests, ESRs, CRPs, serum IgG4 levels. But as I said earlier, and it's really important to remember this, do not be put off by a normal serum IgG4 levels. For reasons that are not clear, 30% of biopsy-proven patients have a normal serum IgG4 level. Now, it's become my practice to request a PET scan in these patients wherever possible. The PET scan is really useful at giving you sort of a half-body PET scan. It's very useful at giving you an idea of the disease burden. And I had another very interesting patient referred over who presented to the urologist at their local hospital with a huge mass in his testicles. And they called him into the clinic. They said, we're very sorry. We think you've got a cancer of the testicle. Yeah. They excised it and the biopsy wasn't cancer. It was classic IgG4 disease. And a few years before that, he'd had abdominal pain, which he didn't seek medical advice for. So once I'd made the diagnosis of IgG4 disease, he had astronomical levels of serum IgG4 disease. I got a PET scan. And to my interest and surprise, his pancreas lit up, even though at the time he wasn't that symptomatic. His amylase was only slightly elevated. So he clearly had autoimmune pancreatitis, as originally described by the Japanese in 2003, in connection with a big testicular mass. So I think PET scan can be very useful if you have access to it. Yeah. And it gives you an idea of the burden of the disease. Now, just another point about PET scanning.
Yes.
In tachyasus, PET scanning is brilliant at making the diagnosis. But once the patient with tachyasus is on steroids, PET scanning can be very hard to interpret. That doesn't seem to be the case in IgG4 disease, and I don't know why. So the urologists, Mr. O'Brien and Ms. Fernando, use regular PET scanning to assess response to treatment. Even though they're on steroids and other drugs, PET scans do seem to light up in the retroperitoneal fibrosis aortitis patients, and it is a useful marker in that very small niche area.
But very interesting.
You have to accept that it is a fair amount of radiation, and I need to be a bit careful about, you know, 6 monthly or regular PET scanning. So we do it to monitor disease activity in selected cases, yeah.
Yes. So the next question, I know having worked with you, you are always very keen on biopsies. And also you've mentioned earlier in this podcast already the importance of looking back at previous biopsies and getting them restained.
Indeed.
Are there any cases where you've started treatment for presumed IgG4 disease without a confirmatory biopsy? And what was the situation if that is a yes?
So working with Emma Culver so this is a plug for the monthly IgG4 MDT. It's a UK-wide MDT. It's organized by Dr. Emma Culver, hepatobiliary specialist at Oxford. It's the first Friday of every month at 8 a.m. And they get through about 15 or 20 patients submitted by colleagues all around the country. And it's a really great MDT if you want to join up to it. Just email Dr. Culver and she'll link you in. So they discuss really complex cases. Obviously, she's got a bias towards the hepatobiliary disease. And, you know, when I sit in on this MDT, they have seen patients where it's been really difficult to get a biopsy. So biopsying the pancreas can be a little bit hazardous. But if the PET scan's hot, they've excluded lymphoma, they've got high serum IgG4 levels, and the clinical picture fits, then indeed it's entirely reasonable to start a course of steroids as a therapeutic trial in that patients. But beware of all the pitfalls of not having a biopsy. Wherever possible, yes, we will try and get a biopsy. But as I say, in the hepatobiliary disease, sometimes it's not that easy, especially biopsying the pancreas. But I think the HPB doctors are quite good at endoscopic ultrasound and doing biopsies that way and getting a diagnosis. But sometimes it's just not possible. And the other area that's really difficult to biopsy is the patients with retroperitoneal fibrosis, where it's sort of encasing the aorta.
Yes.
And that's pretty hazardous. You don't want to be sticking needles in the aorta. So that's probably where we would probably treat them with a presumptive diagnosis, but again, with all the caveats and being careful about treating patients without a histology.
And I suppose another important thing I've learned from you is always revisiting the diagnosis. And if they're not responding to treatment for presumed IgG4, maybe it might be trying to push again and seeing whether or not it's possible to do the biopsy at that point.
Exactly.
So I note that you were involved in developing the algorithm for the management of IgG4-related disease with other colleagues in Europe.
Yeah.
So what is the general approach to the management? I mean, you've touched upon rituximab already, but I think we just need to talk about steroids, et cetera.
So generally, the consensus usually is if you're pretty sure of the diagnosis, you've got a good clinical picture, biopsy is positive, serum IgG4 levels are elevated, we would give them a trial of steroids to see how they respond. So it's usually, as you know, we're moving away from high doses of steroids across the board as rheumatologists and other specialties. The recommendation in that algorithm was about 0.4, perhaps 0.5 milligrams per kilogram per day for a minimum of 2 weeks, and then tapering down, see what happens. Often there's quite a gratifying response. And that's in a way quite surprising, because if you think about it, these organs are fibrotic. When you biopsy them, there's masses of fibrocollagenous tissue. You know, should they respond quickly? But surprisingly, they do. And so they do feel better. And as you watch them, the masses do improve. And then you need a steroid-sparing agent. So all the usual DMARD suspects have been employed. Mycophenolate, methotrexate, leflunomide, azathioprine have all been used. But there was a small randomized controlled trial of mycophenolate in IgG4 disease, which was positive. Very small trial. But because of that one trial, this has now become the standard of care as the second line treatment as a steroid sparing agent. And I must say, we've used a lot of mycophenolate in our patients now. We've rather abandoned using methotrexate and azathioprine. And obviously, one should be very careful about using methotrexate in those patients with renal impairment and renal IgG4 disease, where obviously mycophenolate would be the first choice. So we've been very satisfied with mycophenolate. We are in the process of writing up our experience. And most people agree that mycophenolate would be the first choice as the steroid-sparing agent. Now, rituximab. So the story of rituximab in NHS England is quite an interesting one. So in about 2014, when I'd read John Stone's article, this was very exciting. It was an obvious treatment to go for. So I put in a policy request into NHS England, thinking there's not a hope in heck of getting this accepted. There are no randomized control trials. There's just some cohort studies, very carefully conducted cohort studies, and lots of case series. And to my utter astonishment, NHS England agreed to commission rituximab for the treatment of treatment-resistant IgG4 disease. So you should have failed. They recommend failing two drugs. And I interpret that as if they fail steroids and they failed mycophenolate or another drug, then they're eligible for rituximab. Before the NHS England approval, and before we could do what we wanted, as long as it was clinically justified, I did treat a couple of patients first line with rituximab with very gratifying responses. So these were patients who had massive burden of disease. There was a patient I saw who had massive concrete-like swelling in his hard palate, really enormous parotid swelling, submandibular gland swelling and parotid swelling, a sort of hard palate swelling and swellings around his eyes. And he had a huge disease burden. So we gave him some steroids and I treated him with rituximab. His IgG4 level was over 20, I think, and the limit is about 1, I think. And he had a very gratifying response. Now, he's quite illustrative in the case that he did respond to rituximab, and then I switched him to azathioprine before we had widespread availability of mycophenolate, and he relapsed. And what we're learning now, and all the literature is telling us, what are the factors that predict relapse in IgG4 disease? So that, number one is a high disease burden. Number two is a very high IgG4 level. And the other is an eosinophilia. So if there's an eosinophilia present there, these are all factors that would predict relapsing. So though, you know, one has a low threshold for using rituximab in these patients. So the so-called high-risk patients, you in your judgment, if you think they've got a high risk of relapse, I would treat them with rituximab. Well, mycophenolate first, and if they fail, then rituximab. Now, the $6 million question is, should we be giving them protocolized rituximab like we do with ANCA vasculitis?
Yes, that's my next question.
So I've done that with one or two patients. You know, once NHS England have approved it, I think we can retreat them. But it's not evidence-based as yet, but I'm tending to do that for a very select few patients with organ-threatening disease, massive disease burden, not responding, or did respond to rituximab, but I have a tendency to keep treating them. But I've got two patients, I think, who I'm treating them with protocolized rituximab, but that treatment's not widespread. It's not been adopted widely.
And by protocolized treatment, would you say rituximab every 6 months
years? Exactly. It's all very empirical, Yeg. But yes, it's a gram of rituximab every 6 months for 2 years. And that's what we do for the ANCA vasculitis patients. Yeah.
So I think we probably touched upon this already, but obviously over the years in rheumatology, there's been a very huge push to treat to target. So in terms of monitoring for disease remission, you've already talked about monitoring the IgG4 levels if they've been elevated, potentially repeating the PET scan and seeing if they're in disease remission. Is there anything else that you would also do to look for that for disease remission?
So we don't actually have a target. I mean, obviously the target is remission, but how do you define remission in this disease where you've still got residual lumps and bumps and things? So I think defining remission, I don't think that's yet been addressed. And that's quite a challenge, I'd say, especially given the multi-system nature of the disease. And, you know, how do you define remission in somebody with retroperitoneal fibrosis where the lumps are huge, they shrink a little bit. When you repeat the PET scan, there's still a bit of residual FDG uptake. So I think defining remission is going to be quite hard in this disease. And I don't think anybody's tackled that as yet. But there is an IgG4 responder index that John Stone and his team put together, and you can use that. It's based on the BVAS Wegener's scoring tool. So it's a very simple tool, and you can use that to monitor these response to treatment. And I think it's really been developed for clinical trials. To my knowledge, I'm not aware of active clinical trials as yet. There is one trial of a B-cell agent that we did sign up to, but we haven't recruited any patients to as yet. So there are trials coming out for IgG4-related disease, and Emma Culver is the chief investigator for one of these B-cell depleting agents.
Yeah. And apart from B-cell depleting agents, are there any other recent advances in the field in terms of any other research that's going on?
Yes, there are. So I seem to remember there was a patient treated with obinutuzumab, I think. So again, it's another B-cell depleting agent.
Yes.
But I think this is the field that's ripe for development by the industry.
And apart from anti-CD20, are they looking at other biologics at all, or has that been tried and tested?
I'm not aware of any, given that, you know, B cell is such a prime mover in this condition. I think all the targets are aimed, all the biologics are aimed at depleting B cells. I suspect there are case reports of anti-TNF agents being used. I'm not up to speed with all of them. Mainly the best successes have been with B cell depleting agents and with mycophenolate.
Obviously, you have a lot of experience in managing these patients, and I think it would be great for our listeners to know about any common pitfalls when managing IgG4-related disease. Certainly, the few cases that I've seen all looked like possible malignancies before they eventually had a biopsy and then showed very typical features of IgG4-related disease. So are you able to share any of those kind of pitfalls, any tips for our listeners?
Yeah. So I think you're quite right, Yig. Actually, when these patients present to clinicians, the first thought is malignancy. They've got huge lumps and dumb cells around the body. They've often lost a bit of weight. They often have a bit of fever, modest elevations of ESR and CRP. So malignancy is nearly always the first diagnosis. And then, as you say, a biopsy is imperative when you're considering malignancy, and certainly a PET scan will help you. Now, the PET scan can help you distinguish malignancy from IgG4 disease because it's immediately obvious the burden of disease, the pancreas, the lymph nodes light up, maybe the retroperitoneal area lights up, maybe the aorta lights up. You know, that's a very different picture from malignancy. So PET scanning can be very useful first in identifying any malignancy if there happens to be one, and also just giving you a burden of the disease. In terms of managing these patients, again, assessing response can be difficult. The patients I find the hardest are the ones with retroperitoneal fibrosis and aortitis. You know, they have flank pain, which is often there, and this continues even when the patient's improving. The flank pain is often due to compressive problems from the RPF tissue mass, pressing on the ureters and the pelvic organs. So they can be very painful, these conditions, and certainly a few of the patients that I jointly manage with the urologists, we've had to send to the pain clinic, even though we know they've improved and the markers have come down, but they're just left with this debilitating flank pain. And so we refer them to the pain clinic for nerve blocks, and nerve blocks have been very useful in managing the pain of these patients.
Okay. And on the contrary, being a very inflammatory condition with quite a lot of fibrosis, what is the link with cancer itself? So if someone has long-standing IgG4-related disease, do they have an increased risk of developing cancer such as lymphoma? Because obviously we know that, for example, with Sjogren's, where there's chronic B-cell activation, they are at high risk of lymphoma.
Yeah.
Do we know enough yet about the link with malignancy with IgG4-related disease?
I don't know of any link. Actually, certainly in our cohort, we've not seen patients who had a cast iron diagnosis and then developed a malignancy. The few patients who had a malignancy actually probably had it from the very beginning. We just misdiagnosed it. For example, that patient you wrote up with the IgG4 or lymphoma. Well, that's right. So that's the caveat, I think. But I'm not aware of an increased predisposition to cancer. And as I say, these patients have a really long history, sort of 10, 15-year history. You know, if they had cancer, it would have been picked up sooner.
And do you have any other interesting cases you would like to share with our listeners before we finish this podcast?
So there's a really interesting patient who presented with a huge ulcer on her neck.
Okay.
These two I've got to talk about. So this lady, she's the massive ulcer, very painful, seen for a long time by the dermatologist, not knowing what to do, did a biopsy, rather nonspecific biopsy, and then was referred in desperation to the joint clinic that I do with the dermatologist. And to give him credit, David McGibbon, who's the senior dermatologist I work with, said, I think this might be IgG4 disease. Let's get the biopsies out and look at them. And he was absolutely spot on. This was cutaneous IgG4 disease. And this is a well-described syndrome of cutaneous manifestations of IgG4 disease. So we put her on methotrexate and steroids, and the ulcer gratifyingly shrank down. You know, this was a huge psychological burden to her. She didn't like going out because it was an obvious big lesion. The other patient we had was very florid palmoplantar lesions, pustulosis really, very florid, huge mass-like lesions on the palms of his hands. And again, he had cutaneous IgG4 disease. That's the only organ these two patients had, was the skin. So they were quite difficult diagnoses to make. But the biopsies in both those patients were clearly positive, and both had elevated serum IgG4 levels. So this is a fascinating disease, affects all organs in the bodies. The other patient I saw was a patient with IgG4-related kidney disease who had a massive swelling in the right kidney. And again, they thought this must be some sort of malignancy.
Yes.
But the biopsy biopsy was clearly that of IgG4-related tubular interstitial disease. But as I say, she was the patient who just progressed relentlessly and died from other causes of sepsis, I think, if I remember rightly. Yeah, so very interesting patients around. And as I say, I've seen a child, as you know, I do a pediatric clinic. Yes. With the pediatricians. There was a child with, she was 12, I think, who had a hypophysitis with a pachymeningitis. And that's a very well-described syndrome in IgG4 disease. And she had IgG4 disease, cerebral IgG4 disease.
Very interesting, and thank you very much for your time again. Yeah. I think there's obviously still a lot of work that needs to be done around IgG4 related disease, but it sounds, you know, that there's this really excellent MDT that's been set up by Dr. Mm-hmm. Culver at Oxford. Yeah. So obviously if anyone's interested in that, then that's available. There are some interesting cases we've also included with this spotlight, so you can refer to those if you wanted to do a bit more reading. But I think the take home is, as I've always learned from you, a good history and examination, and always think about a diagnosis, because if you don't think about it, you won't make the diagnosis.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you very much for your time again, David.
Thank you very much indeed, Dick. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Talking Rheumatology Spotlight, brought to you by BSR. Please do rate, share and subscribe through your favourite podcast app.